Good afternoon. We'll get started with the session. This is concurrent session one, Otology. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to be moderating with Karen Doyle. The first paper is generation of intraoperative otologic autografts with 3D subtractive CAD-CAM printing by Glenn Knox of Jacksonville, Florida.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present. My disclosure is that this is a patented process. Conventional milliary prosthetics are expensive. They require a large hospital inventory. They're subject to extrusion and or infection. And in an attempt to prevent extrusion, a cartilage layer is often needed in addition to the prosthetic itself. Homograft materials are obtained from cadaveric sources. There's a controversial risk of infectious disease transmission. They're expensive, there's a limited supply, and they need to be properly stored before use. Autologous bone and cartilage have the advantage that there's no need for inventory. They're obviously free. There's less extrusion and infection, but one needs expensive operating room time for carving, cutting, and fabrication. There's also the questionable risk of implantation cholesteatoma, which is also controversial that I will address in a moment. Subtractive 3D CAD-CAM is a 3D subtractive milling device. It differs from what you may have heard of 3D printing, which is additive. And what this provides is accurate bone and cartilage autografts on demand, which can theoretically save money, since no hospital or surgery center inventory would be required. There'd be reduced OR time, reduced extrusion infection rates, so fewer revision surgeries would be necessary. Possibly also additional new revenue, there could be a CPT code developed for computerized bone graft. In our pilot study, we used a Roland MDX milling machine, which is being used now for the commercial production of orthopedic allografts. And what we used were machinist's wax and bovine bone products, which we used for the proof of concept. We use software which takes advantage of what's called subtractive rapid prototyping. This involves a three-axis CNC milling machine with a fourth axis for multiple orientations. It creates a part directly from a CAD file. The dimensions are imported into an STL file, which is open with SRP player software. The SRP player orients the part and generates tool paths, which are sent to the MDX machine, and the part is milled by subtraction. And this is just an example. And we're just duplicating a Richard's porp out of a cow bone from the computerized input. So our results, machinist's wax, which is blue, and bovine bone utilization resulted in reliable production of prototype milliary prosthetics for a proof of concept. The interesting thing we found was that the surfaces were ultra smooth. They were like a cue ball. So this suggests that lower resolution can be used, which would be even faster. So subtractive 3D CAD-CAM can produce accurate autografts in the OR environment. The technology can save money on prosthesis costs, reduction of inventory, reduction of OR time, and reduction of complications. Less likely to cause extrusion or infection. Further research on human cadaveric materials and prospective surgical trials are being planned. And finally, the smooth surfaces from the computerized milling may address the implantation cholesteatoma question, if it actually is a question. Thank you very much.
You will have time for questions at the end. So we'll go on to the next presentation, which is by Nicholas Wolter and colleagues at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. This is the impact of challenging environmental stimuli on balance in children with bilateral cochleovestibular loss, balancing in a virtual world.
All right, good afternoon. This is not my talk.
Oops.
The pointer is not working. Or the... Do we have the slides up? Okay.
Thank you. Give me a little bit of time to equilibrate.
Yes, that's good.
Yeah, luckily he gave you a minute.
All right, thank you for your patience there. So the cochlear implant team at the Hospital for Sick Children has previously shown that balance is impaired in children with cochleovestibular loss. But what we don't know is if those deficits persist beyond the lab into the real world, or if these children use their environmental stimuli differently than normal hearing children. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Dr. Papson and Gordon are on the Speakers Bureau for Cochlear Americas Corporation. And this is our team at the Hospital for Sick Children. Now, in order to remain upright, we need to be able to integrate information from multiple sensory systems. Traditionally, that's our vision, our vestibular system, and our somatosensory system. But unfortunately, vestibular dysfunction can be extremely common in children with congenital hearing loss, with up to 40% of children having complete areflexia, meaning that they have absolutely no vestibular input to their balance system. Now, in our lab, we measure balance using the Bruning-Sozaretsky test, which is a developmentally appropriate balance test that I'll be talking to you about throughout the rest of the talk. Now, the bot uses these 9 tasks that are scored with either a time to fall or a step count to create a scale score that can be compared between individuals or to create an equivalent balance age to determine where someone is in their balance development. Now, I told you that balance was impaired in children with vestibular loss, but it's often hard to appreciate that because these children walk into our offices. But in 2008, Dr. Cushing showed that implant users had worse balance using the bot than their normal hearing peers, and as you can see in the video there. Now, if these children are walking into our offices, they must be compensating in some way. Now, we know that these children have an increased reliance on vision for their balance, likely related to the cortical reorganization that occurs in the setting of congenital hearing loss. We also know that these children now have access to sound inputs through their bilateral cochlear implants. So if they were able to localize sound-emitting objects in the environment, that might improve their spatial orientation and, as such, further support their balance. So our objective was to determine whether children with cochleovestibular loss use auditory and visual cues differently than their normal hearing peers in order to balance. So we tested balance in 54 children, 18 bilateral sequential implant users who had vestibular loss demonstrated by objective end organ testing, and 36 normal hearing children with about the same age and gender. The majority of our implant users had either Usher's, meningitis, or an abnormal cochlea as the cause of their hearing loss. Now, traditionally, balance assessments occur here, and our offices are in these controlled research environments. And while these are good, they don't tell us anything about how these children balance in their day-to-day lives, nor do they tell us anything about how they interact with their environments. And really, children don't ever actually have to balance here. They have to balance here in the real world with lots of additional auditory and visual stimuli that they could use to either help or alternatively could hinder their balance. And they are completely outside of our control for testing. So even if we wanted to test someone here, we couldn't. And not only that, but for safety reasons as well. But what we can do at the University of Toronto is take them to the Challenging Environmental Assessment Lab, where we have a 270-degree screen visual dome with 360 degrees of sound, where we can use virtual reality technology to essentially assess their balance safely in real-world environments. And not only can I standardize the environments that they're experiencing, but I can manipulate the individual auditory and visual components independently to determine their impacts on balance. It was hard to not start naming those people we'd spend so much time in the simulator. Now, by doing that, we created two visual scenarios, a dynamic street scene that you saw in the video and a static street scene where things were kept fairly simple. We also had two auditory conditions, one where the street sounds were congruent to the dynamic street scene with directional cues, and then a white noise scene where there were no directional cues, and that left us with four virtual environments. So here you can see, in the most realistic environment, where they had rich visual cues and congruent auditory cues, our implant users still had significantly worse balance than their normal hearing peers, confirming what we'd seen in the clinic. And interestingly, although our implant users had a median age of 14 years where they should be using adult-type balance strategies, they still had only an equivalent balance age of a 4.5-year-old child. And that helps us understand how they're able to walk into our clinic, but then at the same time have difficulty standing on one foot or riding a bicycle without training wheels at home. Now, we can also measure balance on a task-by-task basis by looking at the time to fall that you can see on the y-axis there. And on the x-axis, we have the tasks of the bot in increasing order of difficulty. So you can see that in the simplest task of the bot, where they only stood with one foot in front of the other with their eyes open, their balance was relatively similar. But in our implant users, their balance skills rapidly deteriorated as the tasks became more difficult. Now, when we start to look at these sensory inputs individually to see what their impacts are on balance and how they compensate, we are very surprised to find that although implant users have an increased reliance on vision for balance, the complexity of the visual environment had no impact on their balance, regardless of the environment that we tested them in. And equally surprising, even though our implant users have access to bilateral sound cues, the presence of auditory spatial stimuli had no impact on their balance any more than it would have on a normal hearing child. And that was surprising to us because we had assumed that these children would be so starved for spatial information that they would be able to use these inputs differently than in their normal hearing peers. Now, while the type of sound didn't impact their balance, interestingly, there was a measurable improvement in our implant users' balance when their implants were turned on in all of our environmental conditions. Again, this is something that we had confirmed from a previous study. So what we found was that the balance deficits that we'd observed in the clinic persisted in real-world environments, and the balance skills of our children plateaued at 4.5 years of age. We found that the balance ability was not affected by the complexity of the visual input or by the presence of auditory spatial cues, but that their balance did improve when their implants were turned on. We saw that while the balance was similar between the two groups in the simplest tasks, our implant users' balance skills were rapidly overwhelmed by an increase in the difficulty of the task, suggesting that if they are using any compensatory strategies, these are a limited resource, and that it's imperative for us to be able to somehow reestablish the head reference sensory input that they've lost because of their vestibular dysfunction in order to allow these children to move through their environments in a more normal, but more importantly, a safer way. Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the award and allowing me to talk.
Great job. It's my pleasure to present to Dr. Wolter the William W. Montgomery MD Resident Research Award for this work. All right. Next paper will be given by Dr. Susan Emmett from Johns Hopkins. Bilateral hearing loss is associated with decreased nonverbal intelligence in U.S. children ages 6 to 16 years.
Thank you to the Trilogical Society and the moderators for the opportunity to present today. We have no financial disclosures. Hearing loss has a tremendous impact on intellectual development in childhood. Children with all levels of hearing impairment are at risk for speech and language delays. And even with mild hearing loss, children may be adversely affected in terms of their school performance. Several studies have shown that children with hearing loss have a tendency to score lower on cognitive tests, but these do not differentiate between verbal and nonverbal intelligence. This leaves unanswered the question of whether hearing impairment strictly affects the acquisition of language skills, or whether it also affects a child's ability to fully develop their nonverbal intellect. We therefore evaluated the association between hearing loss and nonverbal intelligence in U.S. children ages 6 to 16 years using the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. NHANES 3 is a cross-sectional survey that was performed from 1998 to 1994 that provides nationally representative estimates of the health and nutrition status of the U.S. population. For this analysis, we used approximately 4,800 children ages 6 to 16 years who had undergone both audiometric and intelligence testing during NHANES 3. Audiometry was performed by trained examiners during NHANES, and hearing loss was defined by a low-frequency or high-frequency pure tone average greater than 25 decibels. It was then designated as unilateral or bilateral. Four different cognitive tests were administered during NHANES 3, and we selected the Wechsler Intelligence Scale for Children Block Design subtest for this analysis. Low nonverbal intelligence was defined as a standardized block design score less than 4, which represents 2 standard deviations below the standardized mean. Sample weights were used in all analyses except for Table 1, and the baseline characteristics of this cohort were compared using chi-squared. Mean intelligence scores were calculated using survey mean estimation. And then we use simple and multiple logistic regression to evaluate associations with low nonverbal intelligence. These are the demographic characteristics of the cohort. And this right-hand column shows the children with low nonverbal intelligence, and the left-hand column is children with relatively more normal nonverbal intelligence. There's a couple of important points or differences in this cohort to point out. Firstly, the children with low nonverbal intelligence were more likely to be Black. They were more likely to be from a head of household who has less than a high school education, and more likely to come from a low-income family, which is defined as less than $20,000 a year. The mean nonverbal intelligence scores for the children with bilateral hearing loss was significantly lower than the scores for normal hearing children. There were no difference in the mean scores between the unilateral hearing loss group and their normal hearing peers. Our logistic regression models showed 2 different sets of associations with low nonverbal intelligence. The first have to do with racial and socioeconomic disparities. As you can see on the far right of the column, even after controlling for other social, demographic, and socioeconomic factors, Black children had over 4 times higher odds of low nonverbal intelligence than their white peers. And children from low-income families had over 1.5 times the odds of low nonverbal intelligence. Head of household education less than high school was a significant predictor of low nonverbal intelligence in the univariate model, but not in the multivariate. Similar to race and income, after controlling for other important sociodemographic factors, children with bilateral hearing loss had nearly 6 times the odds of low nonverbal intelligence compared to their normal hearing peers. There was no difference in nonverbal intelligence between the unilateral hearing loss group and their normal hearing peers. There are limitations to our study. There were relatively small numbers of children that met criteria for hearing loss, which led to wide confidence intervals in our analysis. And the effects of cultural differences in language delay on the outcome of intelligence testing cannot be ruled out. There's also no mechanism to study temporality or assess causation with cross-sectional data, which is why future longitudinal studies will be very important. In conclusion, we found that bilateral but not unilateral hearing loss is independently associated with low nonverbal intelligence in U.S. children. Race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status are also important sources of disparity in nonverbal intelligence in this study. In the future, longitudinal studies will be very important both to further define these associations and also to assess the efficacy of potential interventions. 2 possibilities of those include modifying the early parent-child interactions and early screening, amplification, and hearing rehabilitation. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Emmett. That was excellent. It's my pleasure to present you with the James Harrell MD Resident Research Award.
Our next paper will be presented by Pedram Daray, and he and Dr. Maddox, his co-author, are from Emory University, Landmarks for the Preservation of the Middle Temporal Artery During Mastoid Surgery, a Cadaveric Dissection Study.
Good afternoon, Dr. Doyle and Dr. Tutsi. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. This is a pretty exciting opportunity for me. Landmarks for the Preservation of the Middle Temporal Artery During Mastoid Surgery is a cadaveric dissection study that we did. Financial disclosures, we have none. So a little bit first about the middle temporal artery flap. It was first described by Black and Kelly in 1994, as you can see here in this diagram. It's based off the middle temporal artery that courses posteriorly along the squamous temporal bone. It supplies the pericranium, and the flap is actually based off of this artery. It's a pedicled flap, and thus it's vascularized and very robust. The uses of the flap are threefold. First, it can be used in reconstruction of the mastoid cavity after mastoidectomy and the external auditory canal after middle ear surgery. It can also be used to repair CSF leaks in the middle fossa, as well as defects that can lead to encephaloceles. Here's a diagram that Black and Kelly described in their paper showing 5 centimeters worth of superior flap of pericranium, and here's another diagram showing actually how the flap will be utilized. It's folded down into the mastoid cavity based off of its pedicle. Pedicle would be there. So there are three reasons that Black first described characteristics of the flap that are important and useful for its utilization. First, that it's permanent. Second, that it allows for epithelialization without atrophy over time, unlike a muscular flap that does atrophy with time. And the third thing is that it's vascularized, so it provides nourishment to the underlying pericranium and the overlying epithelial layer, which improves survivability. So the purpose of this study, the artery has been described before and the flap has been described, but the relationship to the external auditory canal has not been, and description of the course of the artery along the squamous temporal bone haven't either. And to aid the surgeon in identification, isolation, and elevation of the middle temporal artery flap, we decided to do this study. We described and measured the relationship of the artery to the external auditory canal and described the course of the artery along the squamous temporal bone. The way we did this was through planar dissection of 7 injected temporal bones, paying close attention to the different planes that we face, so fascial planes, muscular planes, or fat planes. We then isolated and skeletonized the middle temporal artery in an anterograde manner, usually by identifying it over the squamous temporal bone, and then retrogradely dissected it towards its origin. Now, we then came up with a standardized method of measurement from the distance, or to measure the distance between the artery and the external auditory canal, and then describe the variability and categorize this. So this is a nice picture of one of the specimens that we use. You can see here is the superficial temporal artery. This is the middle temporal artery here coursing posteriorly along the squamous temporal bone. This is the external auditory canal here, and this is the temporalis muscle. This is a lateral view. And here you have a view looking anteriorly in the plane of the temporalis muscle here. And the reason why I took this photo is to show the depth a little bit better, the association between the middle temporal artery and the superiormost border of the external auditory canal here. So for the measurement, I have it written down here, but I think it's better to describe it as I show you. For some reason, this photo is huge. What I'll do is, I guess I can describe it here. So I took the horizontal diameter of the external auditory canal here, and I took a line and I lifted that line up to the superiormost border of the external auditory canal, and then I split it up into 3/3, so an anterior third, a middle third, and a posterior third. And then what we did was measured those distances. So in the previous photo, there should have been a big external auditory canal about right here, so we measured at these red lines. And this is one of the specimens. Before I get to the results, here we have a very cascading sort of artery going up and then becoming more tortuous towards the end. This is a very classic sort of cascading crisp and clean artery, middle temporal artery, and you can actually see some railroad tracking here that's characteristic of the artery. This is one that's particularly interesting because it's so tortuous, it's erratic, it actually bounces up and down, and at some point right here, dips down into the external auditory canal. Here we have another very robust artery showing the classic railroad track appearance, and another one here. So starting with the course of the artery, every single one of our middle temporal arteries originated from the superficial temporal artery anterior to the external auditory canal. It then coursed posterior superiorly towards the external auditory canal to penetrate the temporalis fascia, and then immediately penetrated the temporalis muscle where it gave off collateral arteries. Then it became closely adherent to the pericranium of the temporal bone as it approached the external auditory canal. So once it did approach the external auditory canal, that's where I took the measurements. Starting with the anterior, it was about 1.5 centimeter or millimeters mean. Middle was 2.96 and posterior was 4.02. The relative difference here is about 2.5 times, but the absolute difference is about 2.45 millimeters, which is still a very, very small distance. So the pattern of the course, first here I split it up.